Hello and welcome to Yes Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games where I interview creators about their games and inspirations and about the theory, process and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, a game design enthusiast, role-playing game editor, indie hustler slash promoter and interview podcaster. You can find me on Twitter at IamFofos and on itch.io at marksofhighwater.itch.io. This week I interview Andrew of Halfling Games, who came on to talk about Betamax Theft, a love letter to film heists of all kinds. We also ended up taking our whistle-stop tour of his other cassettes for the Betamax system. If you like movie references, this is a system and an episode for you. Enjoy! Now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. So, today we're talking to Andrew of Halfling Caravan Games. Hi there, Andrew.
Hi.
Why don't you take a minute just to introduce yourself and tell us what you do in indie tabletop role-playing games.
Okay, so my name is Andrew Trogman. I kind of do everything in my own stuff other than artwork. And for half the games I do the artwork too. I wish I had the money to get a bunch of great artists out there and get them to do the art for me. But, you know, otherwise I make do how I can. I wrote my own system and made a bunch of what I nicknamed cassettes of it. And I also just kind of hook up other random RPGs. I used to do stuff for that particular RPG, which will not be named, and sold it on Roll20 and kind of ended up where I am because I learned to hate Shadowrun. And this is where I am.
We all learned to hate Shadowrun. Yeah. I was talking to somebody the other day about how it's one of those systems where you have to know everything about the setting in order to be able to play it. And that just does not appeal to me in the slightest.
This will actually just lead into where Betamax X comes from, which is the first of the Betamax games. A friend of mine who does this great kind of sci-fi, cyberpunk-y style 3D render art, it's really nice. And if you're ever not necessarily sure what you want to do for some art type stuff and you're in that cyberpunk space, go find Sarah Avery. So Sarah's internet handle is Sunset Industries, but it's missing the first I, so it's kind of Sunset Industries on Twitter. Sarah did the art for Betamax X. So if you see Betamax X, the art comes from two places. One is George Cotronis, who did the very nice cover and some of the other stuff, and Sarah, who did a lot of the other interior art. Now, I was talking to her about doing stuff on Roll20 because she could do the art assets and I could do all the writing and designing stuff, and then we would collaborate and flog it off on Roll20 and split proceeds and all that sort of stuff. But I looked at the Shadowrun book and I went, well, for starters, I have not met a book, even in some of my more crazy esoteric science and math stuff, that has a 5-page, 3-column contents. This is very big. And I think it was Shadowrun 5th was the one that I got. And then someone else said, look, hey, you should look for Shadowrun Anarchy because it's much simpler. And I went and looked through Shadowrun Anarchy. And the problem that I had was, sure, I mean, I get enough about how the system works, but then how are you supposed to gauge difficulty? Amazingly, this pared back system of Shadowrun that I think is based on the 3rd edition of Shadowrun, I think, or maybe the 4th. Anyway, it didn't have anything really obvious about how you set difficulty on something. So if I'm going to sell a product on Roll20, I can't tell anyone if it's supposed to be something that new Shadowrunners are supposed to do or experienced Shadowrunners are supposed to do. So I'm just kind of making this thing and going, I don't know, stuff, which tends not to get stuff sold. And so I just turned around and went, you know what? Like, I've got option A, which is 500 pages and, you know, a 5-page, 3-column, 8-point print contents page book. And then I'm told I may need other books on top of that. Or I've got Shadowrun Anarchy, which seems simple, but it doesn't seem to want to tell me how I make things difficult or easy or how to judge that. Stuff it. I might as well write my own thing by now. And then Betamax X came about.
I think there's a sort of reasonable amount of that in indie at the moment. There's a lot of very short games, which are, yes, a backlash against the kind of 600, 700 page rule books of the game that must not be named. Or in indie, there are very, very narrow, pared down systems which have...
Well, it's like the lasers and feelings, right?
Yeah, they have a lot of expectations about what you are supposed to know about role-playing games before you play them.
Yeah.
And they do not in any way attract a new player audience.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think what the space needs is something a little bit in between.
The design idea behind Betamax is, on one hand, people kind of love the Lunchbox of Dice experience, right? I've played Lunchbox of Dice games. I will admit to a certain level of nerdiness in the sense that I played Warhammer Fantasy way back with Orcs and Goblins and was putting like 160 figures on a table. When I would have a unit of archers shoot, I would be rolling 35, 40 dice.
Yeah, I see why you like Shadowrun too.
Right. I love that experience of you get a big bunch of dice, you stick them in a box, you make a big noise, and you tip them on a table.
Yeah.
But with Shadowrun, right, and this is kind of like one of the jokes I've heard other people say about Shadowrun as well, which is, you know, you roll 4d6 to figure out if you can tie your shoelaces. And if environmental things are wrong, then it might be 7d6 and things could go really bad. So the Lunchbox of Dice experience you get from Shadowrun, there's a good bit about it, right? And it's in wargaming as well. But it's just kind of nuts. So the idea was to do a little bit of Lunchbox of Dice field. It does a d10 dice pool. And unless you're really aggressively mucking around with how the system works, and you can, right? Like I had one guy at a convention basically go, how do you stop people pretending everything's a nail and hitting it with a hammer? And I go, well, you don't. Like if you play with those people, then this isn't the game to play with them. But it kind of caps out at about 10 dice. To get more than 10 dice in your hand and shake them up takes some effort. You've got to have basically hammered hard at this sort of stuff for a while to get to that point.
Yeah.
So under 10d10, so it's a nice good handful. It's a dice cup full of dice.
Yeah.
Right? You're going to be feeling like you're playing Yahtzee with d10s.
I'm thinking back to my 7th C days when, yeah, you did roll d10s.
So it's going to feel like if you've got yourself like a plastic cup from, you know, anywhere, shake some dice in it, roll them on the table. That's kind of the amount of Lunchbox of Dice you're going to get from it. So it's got a nice physical feeling on that front, but you're not counting through 25 dice looking for 5 pluses.
Yeah.
So that's one bit. But then when it comes to how difficult it is to get into the game, that is the only way that the game deals with anything. Put a bunch of D10s together, roll them, check numbers. That's it. Like that's the resolution mechanic everywhere.
Right.
Is roll D10s, count ones. In the same way that D20 games are basically roll the D20, add stuff, and that's like 90% of what they do. When you head into the other bit where you've got all the different die sizes for like damage and all the rest of it, no, Betamax doesn't have that. The Betamax games just go, you roll a bunch of dice, and maybe you roll them again, and maybe you roll them again, and then that's it. So that's one bit. And then the other bit is how you deal with stuff is mostly a matter of you joining things about your character together in a way that makes sense with what's going on. In the core of all the Betamax stuff, there's 9 traits that belong to your character, and they're kind of physical and mental and social traits. And then there's a bunch of skills that get stuck on.
Yeah.
And depending on which cartridge of Betamax, you get additional traits.
Right.
So in Betamax X, you've got additional traits because the system has cyberpunk elements. So you've got like cybernetic body parts and things, but it's also got magic in it. So there's a whole magic section of traits and a cybernetic section of traits. And so they expand your traits table a bit.
Yeah.
Let's say I come into a situation and I want to use something to do with my body. Maybe I'm an agile person and I'm a cunning person, or I've got a high guile. They're 2 of the traits. So I would find the dots in agility. I would find the dots in guile. That tells me how many dice I've got. I roll those. Maybe if my skills come involved, that'll adjust the number I need to roll up or down a bit. And then I check if I've got enough successes. And that's it. That's resolving stuff in Betamax.
Yeah, straightforward.
Yeah. If it makes sense for my character to use their agility and their guile, I think one of the examples in the book for Betamax X is that this particular character has got quite a lot of guile. And so he actually just swipes something off the desk.
Right.
That's literally all he's doing is he's just there, gets agility and guile, and just swipes something off the desk of a security guard while doing some other thing. Because that's sleight of hand, the agility, guile's that cunning sort of tactical thinking. So bang, done. Okay, that makes sense. Roll those dice. Tell me what, if you get so many numbers above like 4.
Yeah.
Maybe we need 2 things above 4. You've got 4 dice, roll them. Tell me if you get that. You do? Great. Story moves on. And so what those other things are just changes depending on the system.
Yeah.
With Betamax X, it's got the magic and the cybernetic. In the slasher horror one, which shamelessly riffs on stuff like Nightmare on Elm Street and The Shining. And by the way, I'll explain the Betamax bit now. Betamax loves pulpy movie genres. The movies that went into Betamax X are things like The Fifth Element and the Star Trek Into Darkness. So it's in that same kind of space as like your action fantasy space opera kind of stuff, right? So
right.
So Betamax loves that kind of The Fifth Element, Star Trek Into Darkness, a little bit of like Blade Runner, So it sits in that kind of a space. It's pulp, right? It's not serious.
Yeah.
Betamax Death sits in your, you know, Friday night, 11 o'clock slasher horror.
Yeah.
The Shining, Night of the, you know, Night of the Evil Dead, blah, 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 blah.
I love the way you describe it as sort of 11 o'clock, because that is pretty much the time that these horror films start on film 4 in my country.
So, like, Elvira should be introducing it at 10:55. That's a Betamax Death game.
And content warnings for gore and violence.
There will be blood. There will be creepy crawlies. There will be bad stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, Shining, Candyman, all that stuff. Betamax Thulu is what happens when I go, I like pulp action. I kind of like cosmic horror. It's thoroughly fashionable and everyone does it. I hate the racism in H.P. Lovecraft. Like, I like the space he wanted to create, but I hate the fact that it's brimmed to the eyeballs with racism. So Betamax Thulu tries to suck a good chunk of that stuff out, but still give you that experience of Indiana Jones and Lara Croft, right? Like, I go down an ancient temple somewhere,
yeah,
trip a booby trap, and then meet a giant spider that speaks French.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's cool, actually, when you think of it as, like, Indiana Jones and Tomb Raider. That is that space minus the racism, basically. The later Indiana Jones stuff, better. No, it's not perfect.
And then time period wise, it's backdated to kind of like Age of Sail.
Oh.
You know, colonial empires and Britain kind of time frame. So it's very much sitting in that kind of frame where, as it mentions in the book, some white idiot goes poking their nose around in the jungle somewhere and find something that they didn't think should be there.
Yeah.
I actually did some collaborative kind of zine things for this with a bunch of people, and we've got stuff like wandering around Paris catacombs.
Yeah.
How could you do weird tales around the Russian Revolution?
Yeah. It sounds like the kind of space that Edgar Allan Poe was writing in, except a bit later.
Yeah, American colonies, right? So there's like American colony stuff. T.K. Johnson did some stuff for it, and they wrote a story basically revolving around a romance and one of the first African-American university campuses in the southern states of the U.S. We had someone else write about a little kind of a little curio shop in New Orleans. So it's that kind of thing. So everything's kind of creepy and a bit colonial and exploration-y, but we're trying to keep it fairly racism light and pulp heavy.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds fantastic.
Right, so it's got a bunch of little materials out there, and then the most recent one, which is the big 190 pages, I think.
A weighty tome.
Look, I do in A5, so it's not super big, right? It's very portable. For those people who are Americans, that's roughly 6x9 size. And yeah, it's 185 interior pages for Betamax Theft.
Now, Betamax Theft is the one that I'm very excited about, because it seems to be like a love letter to Guy Ritchie movies, right?
yeah. So it's basically a general love letter to heist films. I do love a Guy Ritchie movie, but also I love general Cockney nonsense. That maybe that's me being an Aussie.
No, I mean, even as a Brit, I love Cockney nonsense as well.
So there's a lot of kind of heist and crime shows that have all had those touchstones with various bits of like English and Cockney nonsense. I mean, The Italian Job in 1969 has Michael Caine as the lead character and just Cockney nonsense everywhere. It's got Noel Coward, for pity's sake, right?
We need a moment to kind of shout out to the incredible cultural moment that was The Italian Job, 1969. I mean, this is...
Yeah.
Somebody once described this to me as the film that came out inevitably out of the win of 1966 World Cup, where people in England kind of thought they were invincible and that they had the right to make this kind of film. And like, The Italian Job, the remake is appalling, but the original is just so, so good. And if you have never seen it, then you have to go and watch it and then just speculate on what would happen in the sequel.
Yeah, right. I love that the writers were so gutsy to create a cliffhanger that was a cliffhanger.
A literal cliffhanger. I mean, I feel like potentially that is the origin of the word cliffhanger. I mean, it definitely ought to be. That's big spoilers for the film, by the way. But it is so, so good. You never see it coming. You never see it coming. It's great.
It is great. But to give you an idea of like just where this is going, I've stolen quotes for some of the pages from 5 different movies. Set It Off from 1996, and that's the one with like Jada Pinkett Smith and Queen Latifah and a couple of other African-American women who I've forgotten the name of, who form a heist team that goes around robbing banks because one of their friends, one of the four in the group, gets fired from a bank when the bank gets robbed.
Oh, yeah, I have seen that film a long time ago.
It's a good film, right? It's the first movie I list. The second one is The Italian Job in 1969. The third one is Heist from 2001, and that's the one with Gene Hackman and Danny DeVito and Sam Rockwell, and they're trying to do a heist job on a plane full of bullion, and it's just like extended mind games and backup plans and everyone double-crossing everyone else. It's a glorious mess of a heist film.
Also a highly excellent film, yeah.
Very good film. The next one is Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. There's your Guy Ritchie.
It needs basically no introduction, but it is a truly fantastic film. One that I also thoroughly recommend.
To be honest, I always get Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels mixed up with the other Guy Ritchie, which is...
Snatch and Layer Cake. I'm sorry, I just love all of those films. I may spend Friday watching Layer Cake just for the sheer hell of it now.
So, no, it was Lock, Stock and Snatch, and one of them has Brad Pitt doing the worst accent ever, and so they just kind of cover it up and then pretend that they have no idea what he's doing as well, which is brilliant, because apparently that was an unscripted moment which occurred, and they just left it in the film. Brad Pitt's accent was so bad that when he did it, no one else on set actually understood what he was saying.
Oh, yeah. When he's the Irish traveller.
Yeah, the Irish traveller. And so that's when that little scene where the Jason Statham character and the other guy just turn to each other and go, "Do you know what he said? I don't know what he said. Who knows what he said? No one knows what he said." So apparently that's unscripted. And the fifth movie is Ocean's 8.
Now, Ocean's 8 is the only one I haven't seen. I'm very disappointed. I am actually glad you picked that one because the other ones are okay. But then I heard reviews of Ocean's 8 that said this is head and shoulders better than all the others.
The other Ocean's movies, they're Ocean's movies. They're very solid heist movies, but they're not sitting outside the box heist movies.
Yeah.
Die Hard is a great action movie, right? But, you know, there's plenty of stuff that involves Seagal or Arnie or Bruce Willis, and they're good and you wouldn't turn them down, but you'd never say that they were great. I think with the Ocean's movies, most of them are very solid movies that you wouldn't turn down if someone said, "We're going to go watch Ocean's 11. I think Ocean's 8, again, is just a bit better.
Yeah.
That's the film space. But then on top of it, because I can't leave stuff alone, the whole world is full of supernatural junk and loads of slang. So I've made fake Cockney slang to go with a whole bunch of stuff. The police are nicknamed the Pink. If you don't get the link, then just track them through Pink, Pink Pig, Pig Cop, Cop, right? Two Penny Pinks are hired police officers because you pay two pennies for them. And so on, right? But to give you an idea of some of the weird things that go on, you can have unnatural power. So as a character yourself, and therefore expect the rest of the world to have it too, you can have things like fluid-like limbs. So that good old, you know, I get my arm Odo style, reach across the room, pick up something I shouldn't, and then bring it back, and it's now a hand again. You can have spare limbs. If people were watching the press for this, I would mention that you could have Lock, Stock and the two spare arms you keep hidden under your shirt.
Yeah, of course.
So there's that. There's kind of like unnatural physique stuff. And the reference to that that's generally done is the idea of this person who can balance far more cat-like than most other people. So, you know, the idea that you just have things about the way your body works that just aren't quite normal without being, you know, tentacle arms or, you know, you have forearms instead of two.
Like the martial arts guy from Ocean's 12.
Yeah. Or just someone who would just go, "Oh yeah, I need to get from Tower A to Tower B. I'll just shoot this wire over and then walk without a tightrope bar across this thin wire 55 stories above the ground. It's fine. I'll do it. Don't worry about it."
Absolutely. Yeah. Goes without saying.
So that's kind of the physical stuff. And then you've got the spooky stuff, which is all mental stuff. So, and where the mental stuff comes in is you've got encyclopedic, like the blurb that goes with it is like Britannica predates Google. No, not the books you tweet her, that Britannica. Of course she's called that because she's like the books. The nickname isn't that subtle. Don't you know Wishbone? By the way, for those listening, Wishbone is the generic nickname that the narrator gives you, the reader. Britannica is always shown as like a woman in sculptures. Britannica over there loves her Union Jacks, and she remembers everything her eyes see. Give her a book or a couple of websites to read on a topic, she'll have that stuck in her brain in a day or two. She runs Trivia Night because no one wants her on someone else's team. Trivia Night's Thursday down at the White Rabbit. And so like the game stuff that goes with it, you are especially good with information stuff.
Yeah.
But then there's kind of a role play catch that you need to be careful about what you read, because you might either become obsessed with it or you might get totally kind of repulsed by it, and you'll have like topics that you completely avoid dealing with because you just can't handle that topic. But it doesn't tell you what that might be. So you could easily have someone with this trait who has like an aversion to bakery, just cannot deal with cookbooks about cakes. There's ghost eyes, which allows people to see supernatural and spiritual things. People with hyper awareness who just hear and see things. But the catch that comes with them is they find almost every environment too stimulating.
Right.
So they want quiet, dark places. Masterminds, people who are overly smart. One of their theft techniques is to hustle people at chess games. But the catch is that you tend to overthink things, right?
Yeah.
Sure. You're good at coming up with a plan. The problem is you're too good at coming up with a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. You're doing layers of intrigue.
Yeah. The problem is that you always do layers of intrigue, and sometimes that's bad. And so for the next ones, there's the kind of the social powers, the weird social powers. So the gab is basically lets you fake social traits with things that you shouldn't be able to talk to. So within the game, there might be demons. There might be goblins. There are goblins. We'll get to them later. They're not goblins as you know them. Something that you shouldn't necessarily be able to talk to, you can just talk to it. The catch is that you don't understand their language in the slightest. You just talk to them, right? Like it would be like walking into a restaurant run by immigrants, hearing them talking in the kitchen and speaking with them like in native dialect tongue of their particular province. And then when someone says, what were you speaking there? You're like, I don't know. What does it mean? I can tell you what the conversation was about. Yeah, what's the word for blah? I don't know. There's the classic talking with animals. So you could start talking with animals. If you do, you tend to keep pets around and you tend to attract animals of that kind, which gives the GM kind of a way to mess with heists on you. For instance, if you have to be able to talk with cats, you might attract cats while you're standing around doing nothing in particular.
Well, I would definitely choose horses just on that basis, you know, just to have horses show up and cause trouble. Or geese, even better.
Geese, yes. Heists, geese, we need this. And then Machine Whisperer, which openly references the Fonz, at least in one spot. And so the idea is just people that can just talk to machinery and make it work. Right, so their weird spooky power is if your car's not working, they walk up to it and go, hey, baby, we just need you to go, okay? Like, just drive. Yeah. On turns the engine. And that's on top of the usual stuff. And then you've got skills that all run with it. And it runs on the same dice system. The other big thing is no matter how many players you play with, there's always one more character effectively loaded in the game. And that's the criminal crew that you're in. So the idea is that you might have your own set of stats for you, but you're part of a criminal organization of some sort, even if it's just starting off as you know, U4 or U5 or however many there are. They'll have a reputation, and that reputation will potentially impact other things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be notorious. They can have reputation keywords. So for instance, your crew might be known for being violent or honorable or high class or noisy, or it can basically have words tacked onto it as descriptors of the crew.
Have you played Blades in the Dark?
No, I haven't.
Part of the crew system for Blades in the Dark is that they have these keywords as well. I just think it's so useful as a sort of roleplay hook for how you as a group interact with other groups, because they have this reputation. That's a really useful tool for the GM as much as it is for the players. So yeah, I do like that a lot.
Well, yeah. So as things go through, right, each time you increase your notoriety, you're going to add something to your reputation. So the mechanic for this is that basically notoriety is how you drive most of the other stuff with your crew. It's kind of the experience of your crew.
Yeah.
So as you gain notoriety, you're going to gain reputation.
Yeah.
As you gain heat, which is basically police being aware of you.
Yeah.
That's going to make your stuff harder to do. But then you've got effectively what's called the tea leaves. Now, the tea leaves are basically the B cast of your criminal organization.
Yeah.
If for some reason you're doing a longer campaign and your character dies, which technically is hard, but also easy, because if you watch lots of heist movies, there are plenty of times when a character just goes, nah, that's it. I need to get arrested or shot or whatever so the rest of you guys can run away.
Yeah.
That is 100% part of this game.
Yeah.
If you were to do that to your character, then the system assumes that your next character would have come out of the tea leaves that are associated with your crew.
Right. Yeah.
If we speak of versions of the roleplay game that shall not be named, there's plenty of time when you're running on the main quest and then you have to deviate off on a side quest before you can progress the main quest. And so you go off and you do some other thing and then you come back. The tea leaves effectively let this character go do that stuff for you.
Uh-huh.
So you can kind of stay stuck on that main quest. Now, if they screw it up, then you'll be forced to deviate off. But if it's something like, we need a getaway car for this job, you can send them to go do it and they'll have their own sort of success rate.
Yeah.
The bigger the crew around you, the more things they can do for you without you doing them. And as that group expands, you can effectively trade in your notoriety to make that group expand.
Right.
So as you trade in notoriety, you can maybe erase some of your keywords. And then as you build it back up, you add new keywords. So the list of keywords is not an ever-growing list, and it's also not static. You can kind of change it over time.
There's a kind of faction minigame going on in the background then when you're trying to build up what your crew looks like.
Yeah. And then it has its own kind of wealth concept, which may help with other stuff. Rather than tracking gold pieces like many games do, this has basically a wealth roll. So you have a trait which is wealth and you roll dice. And if you get enough dice, then you get the thing that you want. If the dice aren't nice enough to you, you can basically burn items on the wealth track to get successes so you can buy the thing that you want.
I love games that do that, actually. Like, wealth as a stat, I've always liked that. Like, it's doing that in Fate, and doing that in, OSR games where you have a resources die and things like that. Just so cool.
Yeah, it's basically stolen, I think, from a PBTA, maybe Dungeon World. I've forgotten where I picked it up originally. I met it in a Discord chatting somewhere, and someone said that effectively ammo, what happens is when you roll your attack, you also roll an ammo die, and if you get certain values on the ammo die, then you lose ammo.
The Black Hack is an example of a game that did that quite early on in OSR.
Yeah.
It's really cool, and then when you roll a one, then you move your usage die down to the next size and keep rolling that down. It's a really useful way to do it.
Yeah, so the idea for this is that basically you've got a die pool like everything else. If your die pool fails you, you can shrink the pool to get the success you want if you really need it. Otherwise, you're just going to have to wear what the dice do. Mechanically, that's most of it. But, you know, you've got spirits, you've got demons, you've got crazy ghosts, you've got all sorts of stuff. There is a big, long section on planning these things out from both a player and a GM perspective, because it's supposed to sit in that sort of iterative cycle thing, right? Because it's a heist game. Players want to go plan a heist and go steal a something, right? A MacGuffin, a person, or whatever.
Yeah.
So they want to be kind of going, we want to go chase down this thing. The book sets up how you would go about building the structure of that and how you do it with people.
Yeah.
And it has some special rules just in case everything goes to crap. There's two pages about halfway through the book that talk about fixing a pear because things have gone pear-shaped. Mary's bag, as in Mary Poppins, right? You just reach in your bag and you pull something out, but it comes with a cost. There's one called The Plan All Along. If you want to do something, and there's examples there are, if you wanted to force open a lock, then the price of forcing open the lock might be that you have to throw away the tools that you had. Throwing away tools, though, and leaving stuff at the crime scene increases your heat with the police. So if you wanted to protect someone, you could take an injury for them. You wanted to get your car through a blockade, maybe it doesn't take you too far later.
Yeah.
So that's the plan all along. It's My Last Dog is that I choose to stay behind and get character death, whichever version of character death you want to do.
Yeah.
Arrested might be one end, but dead is standard. It's Not on the Plan is one that might let you kind of bypass a spatial problem. And that kind of hits probably the next big idea in this one that isn't in the others is spacing things. So it's kind of not a gridded game. It's a scened game.
Uh-huh.
That's probably a terrible way to describe it.
Is it like the zone maps in Fate, for instance, or proximity maps that you have in Tiny Dungeon, things like that?
Look, if you take the classic movie reference, right, there will be a room somewhere and people are trying to break into or out of it, right? Take your classic bank heist. Your spaces at a bank heist would be out in the street where there's a guy in the car, the front of the bank, the bank vault, the bank offices, and each one of those would be a space. And they're connected to different spaces. So moving through those spaces would be a thing. But then once everyone's in the car, now sections of the road might be spaces. Or if you take Baby Driver, gosh, I love Baby Driver. That's a great movie.
Another one I haven't seen.
Do watch it. I've previously described it as a ballet for cars.
That does sound good.
The whole movie is effectively a series of chases and action sequences timed to music. It's almost ballet in the sense that every part of it is like lined up to music somehow. It's choreographed from front to back, but so much of the movie is just neatly edited and lined up with the music. It was kind of beautiful. It's not necessarily the best heist movie. It's a great action and chase movie. And so if you take that whole vehicle getaway thing, you've got a number of spaces or sections maybe that the players have to get through before they get to the highway and they get away to safety.
Yeah.
It abstracts things out to this point of a chunk, a room, a space, right? A scene inside the bank vault, out on the street, driving the car, this many blocks down to the highway.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a 5 foot squares kind of game. And there's plenty of examples on how to think about that.
Yeah, that is really like how zones and things in Fate were, which is mostly used for combat, but in this, I think it sounds like it's you're using it to map out things, which actually sounds like a really neat way to do it. So I like that a lot.
Yeah. So one of the technique things for a GM, if they wanted to prep all of this stuff, would be to get A7 size cards, and then they could just write stuff on one side that's important and write other stuff on the other side that's important. And, you know, stuff players aren't supposed to know just goes face down. And then players could put who cares what, right? Something to represent them. To say, I'm in this room, or I'm roughly in this space, or I'm in this part of that room, or I'm Dave's outside on the street in the car. You lay them out on the table and you can flip them and handle them. And it's an easy way to talk about effectively how the camera moves through the game.
Right.
Like all the Betamax stuff is this kind of pulpy, movie-inspired stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, ticking clocks, chase mechanics. The combat section is, let me just double check, including all of the weapon stuff, 6 pages.
Brilliant. That is the kind of system I like. Yeah. Implicit combat. Yeah.
It's also pretty short, and most of what it tells you is you roll some dice, you roll some more dice, and then depending on how things go, people get fatigued or they get injuries. And if you get lots of fatigue, then you've got to get carried out of there by your friends. If you get lots of injuries, then you're in real danger and maybe your character's going to die. That's kind of it, right? Like, it's not trying to do much more. And everyone's seen a movie that does that. And then, you know, like even mentioning combat as drama, again, way too many film references. The opening reference is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, because it's kind of a love note to the movies it kind of parodies, but it's waifu, right? It's drama. It's expressed characters saying who they are through the art of beating other people up, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Saving Private Ryan does it in a whole other way.
I thought you might mention that. Yeah.
A whole other way of doing it, right? So combat as drama rather than combat as HP grind.
Yeah. As something that drives the action rather than the whole point, you know. Whereas in certain role-playing games, the combat is the climax of the action. You know, you are moving between combat scenes and you're effectively trying to incentivize the players to fight. Whereas here, you're probably trying to do the opposite.
One of the quote pages, and there's a lot of splash pages with quotes on them, and one of them just says, if you have to use your gun wishbone, not just wave it about, your dog's already pairs, you're playing to live, not win.
And then we don't need any more than that. Yeah.
No, right? Like, it's just, if it gets down to the fact that you're fighting in a heist movie, you're not playing to get the loot. You're playing to not die.
Yeah.
And that's part of that thing that is loading in. There's advice on how you might do longer campaigns in this system. And then, like, sections on antagonists, right? Like, how you might set up a rival criminal gang and have them interfere with stuff.
Yeah.
To give you some of it, one of the first examples is a sergeant and a bunch of constables that are just going to get in the way and be a problem. There's a gang called Jimmy Sparkles and his gang, and it lists them and has like little character sheets for them. A crew called the Longbows, the Tudor Roses, who are a bunch of basically down and outers. They're estates kids, which makes more sense to you than everyone else.
Well, you say that, but I don't live in London.
Yeah, okay.
No, it makes sense to me.
For an Australian perspective, they're in Housing Commission housing.
Yeah, I did spot there that you'd put the police in with the criminal gangs. So, I you know, that's just some respect.
You know, and there's antagonists like Strawberry Fields, who is, yes, a bad reference to a Bond movie, as well as a bunch of other stuff. Strawberry Fields is hired muscle and gets her name from her strawberry red hair.
Right.
Except she's kind of like 185 centimeters tall, so the best part of 6 feet and 87 kilos of just brawn. Right? Like, she is tough. She has the weird body trait, too durable, which basically means that you could smack her with a baseball bat quite a number of times and she would shrug most of it off and still punch you. She is just hardened muscle. And then another one who's actually mentioned as a major antagonist is, and you'll love this even more, DCI Dick Stewart and corrupt Met detectives. This guy was leaning directly into, this guy pretty much lives up to ACAB and is kind of worse. But that's also in those British crime films. I'm trying to think of the other one. There was another one with David Suchet as a pimp and pornography worker who ends up getting busted during a bank heist. It was the one that was roughly modeled on something in the 70s where they suspect that people may have found naughty pictures of a royal.
Yeah, well, there's this whole scene of like 1960s and 1970s police corruption.
Yeah.
So endemic to the London Metropolitan Police and other police forces as well, but particularly the London Metropolitan Police and the being effectively an anti-corruption squad within the police that was almost more corrupt than the rest of the police themselves, which is just incredible. There are so many amazing stories that come out of that era that just make you think, what? Why are we accepting this as a kind of policing methodology?
Yeah. And so the idea behind DCI Dick Stewart and his couple of cronies is very much that the anti-corruption / drugs unit in the Met is worse than the rest of the Met and pretty much is a criminal gang.
Right. Yeah. Totally acceptably. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like the guy runs protection rackets and does hits on people and will arrest people for no real reason. And he gets his lower constables to do the dirty work for him.
Yeah. That's a big mood. Okay, cool.
Yeah. As a character, you might be dealing with this guy as an antagonist and that he maybe wants to get one of you or he wants to get someone you know. And so then you're going on these heists to try deal with that guy. You might be trying to steal some of his stuff, right? So like, it isn't necessarily like you do a bank job. It could be stuff like you're trying to find the stuff to get him taken out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then after that, there's the non-human stuff. So you got spirits and supernatural things, demons, gargoyles, goblins. There's stuff that's listed. But also, like I openly say, if you want to make something up with this system, it's pretty darn easy. It's light on the rules. So you can just make it up and don't worry too much about balance being off because it's kind of not that kind of game. And so, yeah, there's kind of ghosts. And one of the ghosts cooked up is Elizabeth the Vendor, who, for want of a better phrase, lives near Marylebone Station in Regent Street.
Yeah.
And most of what she does is if you're trying to do a criminal job somewhere near where she is, she will remove time off the clock before the police arrive or something goes wrong because she will just go around going, you know, think like street hawker type stuff, you know, thieves, yeah, stealing stuff over there, get your criminals in the basement, and would just do that while you're trying to do your heist. So then you have to figure out how to get this ghost thing to just go away and leave you alone.
Right, yeah.
Because if you don't, it'll ruin your job. Then you get to some of the other ones. Angels and demons are given exactly the same stat stuff. In this system, it doesn't really care if you want to say that a demon and an angel are the same thing. It just makes my life easier doing the mechanics absolutely. To just say angels and demons are just basically the same sort of stuff. Gargoyles are real.
Excellent.
And one of the bits of fiction has one basically get down off a gravestone and tell someone some information that it shouldn't know, except unless it could talk to ghosts. And then it just goes back still and stands there just freaking out people who don't realize. And goblins are real and they have a special powers and stuff. And it's all of this stuff is there and there's character sheets and all the rest of it. And for people who might want to know what sort of things I was listening to and thinking of when I was doing it, there's an Appendix M1 and Appendix M2. They're the only appendixes. One of them is movies and TV shows. The other one's music. And it lists stuff like Baby Driver and Italian Job and the Mission Impossible TV shows from the 60s.
Yes, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and all of them. The Avengers. Oh, gosh.
But like 60s Mission Impossible is pretty much just a heist TV show on loop, right? You could just mine that thing for various ideas and how things could go wrong. And so that's kind of it.
Well, it sounds brilliant. And as I said, throughout, I'm very excited to check it out because it hits so many notes of things that I really like, which are heist films and things set in London and things that have real accents, Brad Pitt apart. And no, it sounds fantastic. It's definitely up my street. What kind of cassettes have you got lined up for Betamax for the future?
It's 100 and something pages and I laid it out myself and I did the art myself and I did the editing myself. So I'm kind of a little burned out on these things. It's just I need to take a break and then think of the next one that I actually want to work on. There's one that's been kicking around, which maybe I'll get into, which kind of plays on the same sort of space as the TV show Angel, the redeemed bad guy and the whole the bad vortex is corrupting the normal people kind of stuff. Right. It's a little bit Dresden Files, but again, the Dresden guy is
not a great person.
No, but that idea of like there is a bad something, and it's, you know, and it's corrupting people, and you need to deal with the things that come from the bad place. But if you start dealing with them too much, then it'll hurt you and maybe make you into a bad person.
Got you. Yeah.
So that kind of something I've been wanting to dabble with.
That sounds very interesting.
Yeah. My headache is making the rules about how you go bad work nicely without getting really into a horrible space.
Yeah, absolutely. I would thoroughly recommend reading the Fate supplement Gods and Monsters, which is probably the best system I've seen of gradual corruption of any game. It's really very good. So, yeah, I'd check that out. That's very fun.
Yeah, I had to check it out.
It is a thoroughly rad system.
Yeah, the losing grip on reality one, which turns up in Betamax Thulu. So it runs on what's called Fracture and Resolve. So Resolve is how much you're going to reject the supernatural event in front of you from actually doing anything. And then Fracture is basically how your nice Victorian scientific view of the world is just getting busted apart by things.
Right.
And when it gets busted apart enough, you develop a psychosis, but then what the psychosis is not fixed in stone in the slightest. So you just, as the person running the character, you just write in, for instance, fear of spiders. And then you basically give it two modes. One is kind of a shutdown mode. One's kind of an overdrive mode. As examples, if you had like an overdrive mode for your fear of spiders, then you might grab the nearest like largish object like a bat and then just beat the heck out of anything nearby. And that could be inanimate objects. That could be other people in your group. That could be the spiders. And you just kind of go to town on the nearby stuff.
A sort of berserk mode. Yeah.
Yeah. But what that berserk mode looks like is up to you.
Yeah.
And then what the lockdown mode looks like is also up to you. So lockdown mode could just be, I run around the room screaming.
That's just a nope moment.
Yeah, just a major nope out. And so what those are, they're up to you as the character, but each one of them basically represents how finding out how the world really works, quote unquote, has just made you different to everyone else and the way you cope with that.
That's a much better take on it than Call of Cthulhu, which is notably shitty in this regard.
Yeah, and it took a little while to settle on that system and to feel good with it. And doing something similar for this kind of stare into the abyss stares into you type Betamax thing, feeling good about what that would look like, I'm not there yet. And without that, I don't want to start writing all the other stuff. Because so much of the fiction would then hang off how that behaves.
Another interesting kind of take on that is the way that Monster Hearts 2nd Edition handles when you flip out into your monster side.
Yeah.
When you become your dark self.
Yep.
And you can do that as a response to a fail state, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
And like you still have agency over your character. It's just you're supposed to be a crappy version of yourself.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, Monster Hearts is problematic for many reasons, but it is a great game for many other reasons.
Tapping into that kind of comic book and movie thing, that is 100% the path of the Incredible Hulk, right? Like, things go bad, Bruce Banner turns into Hulk Smash. Yeah, and figuring out how to make that a game mechanic that works really nicely is a little bit harder when you know that there's going to be multiple people around. Like, if it's just like one superhero type thing, then that's much easier. But potentially having five characters out of the Avengers all have a variation of Hulk Smash or I suddenly combust or, you know, like this person suddenly like rips half the ship out and everyone's in space.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. Yeah, it's difficult. It's why I think Monster Hearts handles it well, because you have reduced, because you still retain your agency, but everybody else is kind of battling you as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that game is deliberately set up to have inter-character tensions.
Oh, of course.
Which you probably don't necessarily want in your system. Gods and Monsters, it sort of works in a similar space where you are all, you're not necessarily telling a story together. You are a pantheon, but you're not necessarily working in codes.
Hello, Greek pantheon.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Honestly, it is a fantastic game. It's extremely well written. There are some real talents on that project.
Yeah.
That's worth checking out just for some of those play mechanics.
That's my big line. I've got to write a quick start sometime for Betamax Theft. There's a quick start for all the others, which is basically like a heavily cutback rules, a module ready to go with pre-built characters. They're out there for the other three, but there's not one yet for Betamax Theft. I have to figure out what that would be. Then I've got my other two little crazy nonsenses, which were cooked up because I wanted to play with other mechanics, Hands of Fate and Assault God and Overthrow Heaven.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which was my little Love of Wuxia nonsense.
That's a good game. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah, it's a fun little nonsense.
Also, I encourage everybody to check out Hands of Fate, if only for the cover, yeah. Which has the most beautiful person on it. Love that cover so much.
I know you love that one. So explain Hands of Fate to other people. I wanted to build a tarot card deck game, and Greek tragedy always revolves around your fate coming to get you in some form.
Yeah.
So when you're creating your character, you get a randomly dealt major arcana from the tarot, and then you effectively check the reference section of the book and it will tell you what your fate is. And your character may go through their little swords and sandals, you know, Argonauts type adventure without any huge major problems. But if it goes bad, you can effectively reveal your fate. And at the same point you reveal your fate, you lock in your final event at the same time.
Ah, that's cool.
No one knows what anyone else's fate is necessarily. Like, if you're about to have a major defeat and you really feel that you need to genuinely win this one, you might then flip the card and go, my fate is this major arcana. And that will potentially get you a win on that front. But, for instance, it might mean that your character's end post the story is that they basically get chased off out of polite society because they're deemed too crazy and violent to live amongst normal people. Or they might just become so distraught with things they go and become a hermit. Or they might become a king of somewhere. So there's all these kind of locked-in fates that are broad but also specific to the different major arcana. So Assault Heaven and Overthrow God is, it's a Wuxia game. And I use Mahjong tiles because how could you not?
And you made your own Mahjong card deck for that as well, which is very cool.
Yeah, I drew my own for that, which if you go see, you'll understand why I got Sarah Avery to do artwork.
No, genuinely, it's lovely. I've seen a few of your projects and actually your art style is really nice.
Yeah, I'm glad someone else
thinks that. I don't think you should sell yourself short.
Look, I'm allowed to have imposter syndrome at least one place, right?
Everyone is. Well, check out those projects because they're both very cool. Assault Heaven Overthrow God game was part of the jam that I ran, which had loads and loads of cool entries. So I will also add a link to that jam in the description so you can just check out the 12 or 13 or so games that were there because they were all very cool. Andrew, would you like to tell us where we can find you on the internet?
You can find me most places by searching for Halfling Caravan Games. That's my website, you know, follow that with .com.au. That's my Twitter handle minus the games. It's my username at itch. It's my username at DriveThruRPG. So Halfling Caravan Games, you'll find me. Just hit up your search engine of choice. It'll turn me up. If you're not sure, it'll be a big yellow logo with a Art Nouveau caravan thing on it. That's it.
Yeah.
That's where you can find me.
Yeah, we'll try and get you back on Yes Indeed next time you've got a Betamax cartridge
or
other game or coming
some other
out,
nonsense.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I guess all that remains is for me to say thank you very much for coming on Yes Indeed and goodbye.
Not a problem. See ya.
Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Andrew for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. In 2 weeks, I'll be interviewing Deep Anyway about the Monomic system and about the current Kickstarter for the Weaver's Almanac. It was a great interview to record, and you're going to love it. Next month is International Podcast Month, and in the spirit of the thing, in addition to my normal planned schedule, I'm interviewing those bastions of the indie scene, Actual Play podcast showrunners. In between my regular episodes, I'll be releasing 3 bonus episodes, Art from Stories of a Broken Sun, Reef from the Magpies, and Logan Jenkins from Very Random Encounters. Check out these very special episodes to hear some very cool people. If you enjoy Yes Indeed Pod, please rate and review the show wherever you find your podcasts, or consider donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at IamPhophos, that's IamPhoPhos. I'd love dearly to hear from you. Lastly, music credits. All music is from BitQuest by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com and Filmmusic.io. Thanks, Kevin! Until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.